Hello, listeners and followers. So, this past weekend, August 6th, was the 244th anniversary of the Battle of Oriskany. We've talked about it before. For those that live in the Mohawk Valley, you may have been there before, and if you haven't, I encourage you to go and walk the path. It's not far, maybe a couple hundred yards, but it's, you know, well maintained by the state. It has placards throughout the battlefield, kind of let you know what happened at what points. But just a little recap. August 6th, 1777, General Herkimer, out of the Little Falls area at the time, brought his Tryon County Militia, and there was a little over 750 militiamen, and they engaged British forces at the Oriskany Battlefield on their way to Fort Stanwix. Fort Stanwix was being sieged by the British. It was, you know, the furthest inland colonial army base, right? So at that point, the furthest in American base. Same thing, if you haven't been to Fort Stanwix, I encourage you to do so. National Park, so it's, you know, it's really well funded and managed. A lot of people there to answer questions, and during the weekend they have reenactors sometimes that will kind of show you what the fort would look like or what things would do. So, August 6, 1777, the British find out that Herkimer and his militiamen are on their way to Fort Stanwix, which was also called Fort Schuyler. I'm not 100% sure what the name was used at that point, and I owe you an answer on that. I probably should have had an answer for that. Anyway, the British and their Native American allies at the time, and some other loyalists, they set up an ambush at the Oriskany Battlefield, which mileage-wise is about, I would say, like 5 miles from Fort Stanwix. If you drive by car, it's about 15 minutes, but the path that they were taking was a military footpath leading to Fort Stanwix. And roughly 10 a.m. that morning, the first shots rung out. The battle lasted roughly 5 hours, and Herkimer sustained 450 casualties, whether they were killed, wounded, or captured. So if you think about in pure numbers, more than half of his force was now combat ineffective. And for those that, you know, are in the military or were in the military, have any idea that, you know, it's very difficult to fight if you're more than half of combat ineffective. Normally, if you're even, you know, 10 or 15%, then it's a whole different story. So he literally lost the ability to use more than half his men. At that point, you know, 3 p.m., 4 p.m. in the afternoon, they ultimately broke the battle and they started to head back towards Herkimer's house in Little Falls. And basically, that's where all the Tryon militia was from. There's 3 battalions in the Tryon militia. If you think of like German Flats, and even into Frankfurt, that was kind of the furthest west the militia was pulled from. And then it went all the way east towards, you know, past Little Falls, into Fulton, Montgomery County, out that way. So they, you know, they make their trek back. Why was this battle important? It's always a topic for debate. I personally think that it's one of the most important battles in the Revolution, because if you look at, although Herkimer lost a large number of forces, and, you know, any loss of life at that point would have been difficult, right? We don't have a huge population in the country at that time, but nonetheless, by them breaking, well, by them even engaging in the British, they slowed them down, right? So it was a turning point, because the British, even though they won the battle in the day, they lost the battle overall. Morale, some of the natives decided to leave the British at that point, right? And if Herkimer didn't slow the British down and they marched all the way from the Mohawk Valley to Albany, you know, they would have picked up any loyalists on the way, all the food on the way that they could have gotten, and they would have been able to reinforce troops that were about to engage in the Battle of Saratoga, which was about a month later. Because of the actions by General Herkimer and his men by slowing down the British and really sustaining them a blow as well. It really let the American army at the time set up and be and have an advantage at Saratoga, and ultimately lead to the surrender of General Burgoyne and his forces at that point. And, you know, Oriskany plus Saratoga was also a real reason why, well, not a real reason why, but it gave the French the encouragement, and they knew, okay, the, you know, this new this Continental Army, these colonial soldiers who are now fighting for independence, if we do support them, they have a chance to win. Because previous to this, you know, we were really looking for a victory somewhere, shape, or form for morale, but also to encourage them, hey, come to our aid and, you know, beat this British global power that you've been fighting forever, right? So, this was also kind of considered part of the Wilderness Campaign. Previous to the Battle of Oriskany, I wanted to bring a Battle of Oriskany because the anniversary was last week, right? And I love going up there. I love going to Fort Stanwix. I like going to Steuben's house. Obviously, I talk about them all the time. But I started reading a book, The Wilderness War, by Alan Eckert. And I'm not really far through it at all, but there was a couple items that I read recently, and I wanted to bring them up because I think that having an understanding of how the Iroquois Nation worked is important if you live in New York, right? Because we learn it in the history books. We learn about the longhouses and the difference between the Algonquins and the Iroquois. But it was such an important factor in the politics and the forming of this area, and also leading into the revolution. So if we have an understanding of kind of what the Iroquois workup was going on and why they had loyalties to where they did, it makes sense to why they fought on which side they fought on. So we did an episode before about the Iroquois Confederacy, right? And we talked about like Hiawatha and the Peacemaker and the Onondaga Chief. Those three were players in the Iroquois Confederacy a couple hundred years before the Battle of Oriskany ever took place. So the kind of bigger player that we think about when we look at the American Revolution would be Joseph Brant. Joseph Brant, at the time of the Revolution, was the chief of the probably most ferocious tribe of all, and that would be the Mohawk tribe. It did not fall in the village of Mohawk, right? German Flats. Maybe parts of it reached that way. But the Oneida Indian Nation kind of covered the greater Utica area. So you had the Mohawks all the way to the east. You then had the Oneidas, the Onondagas, the Cayugas, and the Senecas. The five main tribes. At some point in the 100 years leading up to the Revolution, the Tuscarora tribe fled to the Iroquois Nation for protection, and they became the sixth tribe. They didn't have voting privileges for quite some time in their existence, but ultimately they became the sixth member of the Iroquois tribe. So you have six tribes that span across what we would consider New York State, you know, going east to west. And in the years leading up to the Revolution, particularly in the early 1700s, you had the entrance of Sir William Johnson. So William Johnson was a Briton, and he was ultimately adopted into the tribe and became the official representative of the Iroquois League. Like, he was a white man who was trusted so much by the Iroquois that they adopted him into their culture. They gave him his own Native American name. They trusted him. He was able to move freely throughout the tribes. But he was also a white man from Great Britain, right? So I'm sure there was some things in there that and motivations to do so, right? From reading all that, everybody liked this individual. I mean, obviously they did by adopting him into the tribes, right? He was, I think, around 27 years old when he was ultimately accepted into the Iroquois Nation by the Oneidas. The chief at the time was Chief Tayanoga, and he was the one that ultimately adopted this 27-year-old white man into their tribe. And another individual is Nicus Brant. So at this point in time, in the early 1700s, a lot of these tribes have been already contacted by Christian missionaries. So you start to see the use of American, or at the time, English names and Christian names. So 1710-ish, right, early 1700s, you see this introduction of So disregard my 1710 for now, okay? But ultimately, when Sir William Johnson was adopted into the United Tribe, the seat of the United Tribe was right in Canajoharie. And also, let me retract that statement. It was not the United Tribe at the seat of Canajoharie. The Mohawk Tribe seat was in Canajoharie. So, in the roughly 50 years leading up to the American Revolution, I would say in the 1740s, there was a time where Sir William Johnson was adopted into the Mohawk Tribe. So, I want to say it's 1742-ish, but nonetheless, he was 27 years old. He developed this relationship with this chief, Tayanoga. Okay, Chief Tayanoga in the early 1700s, in the 17 time frame, had actually gone to England to meet with other individuals. So we have this other player in the Mohawk tribe, Nicus Brant. Nicus Brant had married a Native American female whose name was Owanda. Owanda had given birth to a son, Joseph, and a daughter, Mary. And they were given Christian names upon their birth. Her original husband had died in a hunting accident, and she lived closer to the Ohio border. She was originally from the Mohawk tribe, and upon the death of her husband, she went back to the Mohawk Nation. I keep saying Oneida because it's embedded in my head. I always say that because we live so close to it. But anyway, she goes back to the Mohawk Nation in their tribe. And they obviously take her back in because it's her family. She thought her father would still be alive when she got there and knew that she would be taken care of. Upon getting back to the Mohawk tribe, her father was dead. But Nicus Brant, who was a very good friend of her father, took her in. At some point over the next year, she ultimately married Nicus, and they had a very, very great relationship. I mean, they loved each other. She loved him even more than her first husband. And he adopted Joseph and Mary. So that's where we see Joseph get the name Brant, Joseph Brant. And then you had Mary Brant as well. Anyway, William Johnson at the time was friends with Nicus, and he had met his new family and his wife, and they, you know, he also had a child that was close to Joseph Brant's age. They thought that they would be friends growing up because of their age being close, but ultimately throughout time that didn't happen for other reasons. But anyway, Nicus raised Joseph as his own and Mary as his own, and Joseph, even at a young age, was thought to be very intelligent and just in the things that he did. So when Joseph was about 15 years old, he rode alongside the chief of the Mohawk Nation to go into battle. Many of the other chiefs of these tribes wanted to be the one to ride with him because that was an honor to ride along with the groups, right? So this chief had obviously seen something in Joseph, and Joseph was very intelligent. And over the years, he would teach him things. So Tiyanoga ultimately was the one that explained to him how the tribes joined, when Hiawatha, went to each tribe and tried to get them to agree upon things. And he explained to him, the east and western limits and how come we have these long buildings with doors on the outsides and this the symbolism behind it. How their government works. The tribes have representatives, they elect them, and they have special rules, and they call chiefs into Congress. I mean, there's so many parallels to how we run our government now. But with important matters, unlike our traditional democracy now, all tribal representatives had to vote. And they were the voice, obviously, for their tribe, just like our elected officials were. But if war was ever declared, everybody must vote in favor or against. There was no majority vote. There was none of that. And any disputes that they had between the tribes were supposed to be taken care of and arbitrated at this Congress or Council, what they would call. And never under any situation should they be settled through violence within those tribes. Okay, within the six. That's not to say they could go to war with other tribes, and that happened through time. But we see Joseph ride in the battle with the chief when Joseph was about 15 years of age. And as they were riding into battle, the chief had told them this, and it's a pretty long script, and this is what the chief said. I found this in the Wilderness War book, but these are the words from Chief Tiyanoga. So to quote that, the Chief Tiyanoga ultimately said this, but page 12 and 13 in the Wilderness War is where this quote comes from. And I think that it's worth saying and looking at, because it kind of gives you an idea of how they valued life within the tribes compared to how our government at that time, the British government at that time, the French government at that time, and even at this time, how governments value their troops, right? So this is what was said. We Indians go forth to battle, to war, smarting under a sense of repeated injuries and indignities that we have suffered. We resort to stratagems that are praiseworthy. The very bravest warriors know it is no disgrace to lurk in silence and take every advantage of your foe. And we always triumph in the superior craft and sagacity by which we are enabled to surprise and destroy our enemy. The natural principle of war is to inflict the most injury to our enemy and the least harm to ourselves. As our tribes are sharply limited in the numbers of warriors and the weapons with which we must fight, we therefore resort to every strategy to save our numbers. We do not ever consider even our lowliest warrior expendable, and to trade a life for a life in the matter of a war is a fool's bargain. We the Iroquois, and especially the Mohawks, Joseph, have the most lawfully contempt of death, but for the benefit of our nation and of our league, we preserve our lives for the common good. So, when I read that, that's pretty deep shit, right? But anyway, those were the last words the chief and Joseph ever had together, because during the battle, something had separated them, and the chief was ultimately killed by some Indian boys from the tribe that they were fighting at the time. And although the chief's death was rough for everybody, obviously things went on, and Joseph Brant's life continued as well. This is really where he developed himself as an icon in the Mohawk culture and the Mohawk tribes, because he was involved in many more battles, and he consistently got better. He was always getting better. He was always learning. He was always absorbing things around him. And most of those things didn't come from reading books or being trained at a white man's school that he went to when he was older. Most of these things came from the chief at the time and from learning from Sir William Johnson. So you're creating this bond. Sir William Johnson was knighted by the British government. He was a British citizen living in the colonies. Their affiliation and tie with Sir William Johnson dated back decades before the American Revolution. Sir Johnson even married Joseph Brandt's sister, so that tie was even more so attached. So when we look at the Revolution and it kicks off, obviously the Mohawks are going to try side with the English. There's no way they wouldn't. Now, the bigger question would be, are the other tribes going to follow them in that act as well? Brandt, throughout battle, and there was a situation in which they really, and he really, developed his, like, persona, right? Or they just knew that he was a savage. And I don't use savage as a derogatory term. I mean, like, I use savage as normally a positive term. Like, man, that dude's a savage, right? Like, he has the traits needed to do those things. So, Joseph got this image of being this fearless leader in battles that led with other tribes leading up to the revolution. In one point, the Senecas were trying to kind of break off and side with the Delaware tribes, and Chief Pontiac had made this confederation of tribes: Ottawas, the Chippewas, the Potawatomis, the Hurons, and others. And Pontiac and his tribes were fighting against the British in the 1760s. So they had sieged a majority of the British posts in the Western Wilderness, right? So every British port west of Niagara, except for Detroit, had been taken by Chief Pontiac and his tribes. And one, that news was very serious. But even more unsettling about it was that the Senecas were also involved with it, with these battles under Pontiac. And the Senecas were supposed to be part of the Iroquois League, and they were supposed to be on the side of the British. And in a particular battle, they had entered Fort Venango on the Allegheny River, and they butchered every soldier at the garrison, except for one, and that was the commanding officer. So they butchered his entire force. They made him write a list of grievances to the crown, and they tortured him for 3 days until he died. And it gave the British an unnerving feeling that the Indians may not side with the British. But upon Joseph returning to his tribes from school in 1764, he rode to Chief Pontiac's tribe and was kidnapped on the way, ended up in a Huron village, and Pontiac let him address everybody, knowing that Pontiac's reign and his ability to control the tribes that fell under him, he knew that they weren't going to listen to the Mohawks. But nonetheless, Joseph and his delegation pled, "Stop doing what you're doing. We are friends with the English. We are on their side." And, you know, Sir William Johnson obviously had something to do with that as well. Pontiac was correct, and he knew that, you know, the Iroquois weren't trying to go to war with them. So even though the Mohawks went out there and said that, hey, we need these people back, Pontiac called their bluff. He's like, you're not going to fight us for the Senecas back, and you're not going to do anything. So they were starting to also do these raid parties, and these were the Delaware Indians into Pennsylvania and other places. And ultimately, there's no other option but for the Mohawks to engage with the Delaware Indians to stop this. And at the call of Sir William Johnson, he finally, you know, as an ally to the Iroquois, was like, you guys got to stop this shit. Like, this can't go on anymore. So he sent out, you know, three groups to destroy the Delaware towns on the Susquehanna, and the killer captured Delaware chiefs. there were three people that led these expeditions: Henry Montour, John Johnson, and Joseph Brant. And all three of them were successful. But this is where Brant really showed himself and where he became what he is. So when Brant came back, he had three prisoners with him, and he had the scalp of a chief who was the nephew of a powerful Delaware sachem named Squash Cutter. These actions brought him, you know, an incredible amount of clout. And, you know, he had brought in the scalp of an individual who the other tribes thought was invincible. So, you know, imagine this person throughout history has been invincible and you come back with his head. Like, you are a legend, rightfully so. But ultimately, this led to the Senecas being like, okay, well, we're coming back to the Iroquois Nation, and we're not siding with the Delawares anymore because you guys are serious about this. So at that point, you know, it was easy to make the assumption and the assertion that moving forward during the war and leading up into the war, because even though this was only in the 1770s and a little bit before, there was already thoughts that the American Revolution was going to happen, or that things would eventually turn violent and turn into a civil war. And, you know, it was known that at this point the Iroquois are going to side with the British throughout this campaign and throughout the Wilderness War, whatever that may turn into, whether it's against the other Native American troops or if it is against the colonials. So, thought it was important to share. I know there was a little section in there where I confused. I kept saying Oneidas, but for the most part, they had nothing to do with the story that I told today. So, if it sounds like I said Oneida out of place, I probably did. Just reinsert the term Mohawk, and you'll be good. I appreciate the listen. Hopefully, here shortly, in the next couple days, David will come on with me and talk about his trip up here from July, where we went to Oriskany and Fort Stanwix. We went, took him trout fishing in some cool places. He stopped at the Battle of Saratoga. I think he stopped at Gettysburg along the way. I stopped at the Battle of Lexington and Concord. And there's just a lot of things that, you know, we did in that week-long period that I think would be cool to talk about to you guys. So thanks for listening. Please like the Facebook page, The Little Military Podcast. I post things on there occasionally, especially like moments in history or if it's like an anniversary or something. And we will go from there. So, like I said, please like that. Subscribe on whatever platform you listen to, Spotify, Google, CastBox, whatever else is out there. And if you want to become a donor, you can follow the links on our Facebook page or under the platform you listen to, and you can actually like make reoccurring donations. Or if you want to become a sponsor, you can message the Facebook page, and there's always opportunities for that as well.